Our economy, I think, still, the fundamentals of our economy are strong, but these are very, very difficult times.
That's Republican presidential candidate John McCain on the campaign trail yesterday, reacting to all the upheaval, the meltdown on Wall Street, prompted by the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, the Merrill Lynch merger with Bank of America, and AIG's need to restructure. McCain's comments prompted Barack Obama to wonder what economy John McCain was talking about. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, September the 16th. And we will talk about what happened yesterday and what is still to come, perhaps, and what it means for our pocketbooks and our politics. We'll have two different guests during this hour, starting with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being here. So what happened yesterday?
Well, people shouldn't focus that much on the particular events of yesterday. We're in the middle of a housing collapse, a collapse of housing bubble. Housing is a heavily leveraged asset. There's a huge amount of money, over $10 trillion out in mortgages, and there's a huge number of derivative instruments. And what we're seeing here is the inevitable meltdown that results when house prices collapse. And a lot of this debt goes bad. So you had these financial institutions, obviously Lehman and AIG, now Merrill Lynch being the latest, but before them Fannie and Freddie, and before them Bear Stearns. You had these financial institutions that were very heavily leveraged in mortgage-related assets, and they're paying the price for it. So, you know, this isn't going to be the end of it. There will be more. Yesterday was certainly, you know, an unusual day, but this is far from the end of it. We're going to see a lot more of this.
Yeah, what else can happen? Or I was just talking to an economist last week about the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac takeover, and he said that the worst is not over yet. So what's still to come?
Well, we're going to see more bank failures. That's virtually guaranteed. The question is how big. You know, will they be real big ones, mid-sized ones? You know, we had Indy Mac, which was the biggest failure since the mid-'80s, early-'80s, when the Continental Bank went down in Illinois. We will see more bank failures. My guess is that we'll almost certainly drain the money in the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which will mean that Congress will have to appropriate additional money, you know, just as it did with the S&L bailout when the Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation was drained. So we'll have to see a similar bailout of the Deposit Insurance Corporation. So we're going to see a lot more of this, perhaps more insurance companies. I mean, part of the story is, you know, we don't know exactly who has the bad debt. Warren Buffett has this great line that when the tide goes out, we find out who's swimming naked. And, you know, that's going to be the story here. We're going to find out who's got the bad debt because, you know, they don't, the banks, the financial institutions don't volunteer it till they have no choice.
I heard commentators using the depression word again. Is that possible?
No, I mean, well, let me put it this way. It is possible, but there's no reason we should have a depression. You could have really bad policies. I mean, basically, we know better than we've learned the lesson of the depression. We know how to avoid a depression. So it would only be if we had really bad policies that we would end up in that sort of situation. Now, I'm saying I don't expect that. I think it's highly, highly unlikely, but I will point to the example of Japan as a country that did have a collapse of a housing and stock bubble at the same time back in 1990. And then because of very bad policies, they remained in a slump. I really wouldn't call it a depression, but they had, you know, 13, 14 years of very slow growth. And it was really only until, you know, the middle of this decade that their economy really began to get on its feet again. So you could envision with bad policy that we will be feeling the impact of this for many years to come. But even in the best case scenario, you know, we are looking at a recession. I don't know it's even worth debating anymore whether we're in a recession. Mm-hmm. Some people do, but I think that's kind of silly. We clearly are by any reasonable measure in terms of the impact on the public, and I don't doubt that it is going to get worse. The unemployment rate will get higher. We will see quarters of negative growth, most likely a third quarter beginning the current quarter. So we are in for some very, very bad times, but I wouldn't make any comparisons to the Great Depression. We aren't going to see that.
Some were making comparisons between what John McCain said, though, and what Herbert Hoover said, that the fundamentals of the economy are strong or sound.
It was a peculiar comment. I'm just saying, you know, purely from a political standpoint, you know, people are hurting. I mean, it's just a very, very strange remark because, you know, whatever he thinks about the economy, you know, for someone running for president, I don't really think you want to try and tell people that they're not hurting when, you know, people have lost their jobs, they're worried about losing their jobs. You know, tens of millions of people have seen much of the equity in their homes disappear in over a 2-year period, money that, you know, they felt they'd built up over, you know, many decades in some cases. It just seemed like a very odd comment.
Well, he went on to say that he and Sarah Palin were going to clean up Wall Street and Washington when they get into the White House. What could they do? What could any presidential candidate do?
Well, there's a lot of things that can be done. I think Wall Street has become a huge problem over the last, you know, quarter century. Basically, it's run amok. And, you know, this is policies, you know, bad policies on both sides. I mean, this is, you have President Bush obviously in office now, but, you know, President Clinton was a big fan of deregulating Wall Street. Robert Rubin was his Treasury Secretary, top economic advisor through most of his administration. You know, he was a big proponent of repealing Glass-Steagall, the main regulatory measure for investment banks and commercial banks. And, you know, so this is something that both parties have had their hands in. And, you know, the result of that is we have this hugely bloated sector that got in way over its head. I mean, this is why the banks are going under. They basically didn't know what they were doing. Now, as they were doing it, they were making enormous profits. And, you know, most importantly, the people running the companies were making enormous salaries. So you have any number of people at Merrill Lynch, you know, Lehman Brothers, the places that have been going under that have pocketed tens of millions, in some cases hundreds of millions over the last few years, but they left bankrupt companies behind them. So, you know, we have a very, very serious problem with, you know, corporate governance on Wall Street, the conduct of these firms that really has to be addressed. I have no idea what plans, you know, John McCain and Sarah Palin might have. They certainly haven't given any indication of it. Barack Obama's indicated he supports tighter regulation, but, you know, that's, at this point, you know, an empty shell. We don't know what that means. Clearly, to my mind at least, I think we do need some much more serious regulation, but what shape that will take, you know, no one has put on the table.
We're talking with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research, about the continued troubles on Wall Street. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question for him, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 18 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, September the 16th. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn and her guest will talk more about the Wall Street meltdown with Lehman Brothers filing for bankruptcy, Merrill Lynch selling itself to Bank of America, AIG, the world's largest insurance company, planning a major restructuring. The news yesterday led to the Dow posting its largest one-day loss since the September 11th attacks. And according to the wires this morning, one market watcher says today was a bloodbath in Asia. Stocks dropped sharply, and that's been followed by big declines in Europe, all reacting to the Wall Street news. We're also talking about that this hour. Dean Baker, our guest, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. Our lines are full, but before we go to the phones, Dean Baker, this is causing ripples worldwide.
Yeah, I mean, our financial markets are intertwined. So, you know, well, two things. One is you had people investing in the United States in these firms from all over the world. The other thing, though, is all these countries, or I shouldn't say all the countries, at least many of them had their own housing bubble. So, you know, there's a housing bubble in England that was perhaps even larger, at least relative to the size of the British economy, than the U.S. housing bubble. Spain had a housing bubble. So many of these countries are experiencing their own difficulties on top of the fact that, you know, they have invested in, you know, in Lehman, in Merrill Lynch, and also in, you know, U.S. housing market, you know, financial assets here. So it shakes up everything. It's all tied together now.
Yeah. Let's take some calls. Virgil in Marshfield. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I was just curious to find out if you know the reason why banks aren't failing in Canada.
I don't have a real good understanding of the Canadian system. Mm-hmm. As I understand, they have a relatively small number of very large banks, so you have a smaller you know, you're less likely to have sort of these small banks go under. Now, obviously, some of the banks that are failing now are very, very large. They also had not had a big housing bubble until the last few years. They actually did get one just, you know, much later than ours. Ours dates back to the mid-90s, but theirs began to explode just 04, 05, 06. So my guess is that they will see serious stress. Whether you see failures there or not, I don't feel enough of an expert on the Canadian system to comment.
Thanks, Virgil. Gene in Madison is with us now. Hi, Gene.
Yes, good morning. I have a question concerning Graham Leach Blaney and its relationship to the Banking Act of 1933. I hope this gets discussed much more because I tried to talk about it months ago, and now everybody finally talks about it. Senator Graham, who happens to be John McCain's chief economic advisor, happened to author the bill, which, it is true, President Clinton signed. It deregulated the banks. It allowed banks to take over investment banks, to take over stock brokerages, to take over insurance companies. The Banking Act of 1933 was put in place because the Depression indicated you can't have those groups together because they can't be trusted to behave rationally together. We didn't listen to it. I would say that Senator Feingold and Representative Baldwin voted against this stupid legislation, but what are we going to do now that we have to relearn a lesson of the last Depression?
All right, what are we going to do, Dean Baker?
Yeah, well, I'm willing to bet that we will be seeing a lot more regulation of the financial sector, and my guess is that at the end of it, and the end might not be too far down the road, we're actually going to see the industry itself pushing for regulation, because one of the stories here is that no one trusts them anymore, exactly as Gene had said, that, you know, people know that they can't be trusted. And, you know, when people are making fun of, you know, Fannie and Freddie, you had a lot of the conservatives saying, well, these were government institutions, blah, blah, blah. Well, they're obviously mixed. But the fact of the matter was, for all the problems of Fannie and Freddie, they're still standing. The private issuers of mortgage-backed securities had all gone out of the business because no one will buy their securities. No one trusts them. So my guess is that we're going to have the financial industry actually asking for government regulation because no one can trust the U.S. industry. It'd be like going to Zimbabwe. Would you trust the Zimbabwean financial institution? We don't know anything about it. You know, why would we trust them? You know, it's going to be the same with Wall Street. People don't trust them. And if you're a financial institution, there's no trust, you might as well just shut your doors.
Yeah, so the government, though, takes over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but is going to let these other companies bite the dust.
Well, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac basically are supporting the mortgage market at the moment. The financial, the private secondary market, as I said, had basically disappeared. And given the housing sector is already in turmoil, I think the last thing anyone wanted to see was the secondary mortgage market just shut down, which is what would have happened absent a takeover of Fannie and Freddie. So I think no one wanted to see that, so I really don't think there was much alternative to taking them over and, you know, keeping them in business.
Yeah. Greg in Middleton is with us now. Hi, Greg.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I've been listening to this discussion on the credit crisis for several months now, and there's one very crystal clear point that no one has mentioned. And I can speak to this point from experience. I spent 15 years earlier in my career working for Freddie Mac. In the mid to late 90s, the policymakers, the folks in Congress, specifically decided that homeownership is an entitlement and not a privilege. In doing so, they put ridiculously high affordable lending goals on banks and, by extension, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. In other words, they were forced to buy, to issue loans and Freddie to buy loans that were not good loans. Now, at the time, in rising with property values appreciating, rising values can cover up a lot of bad loans. But when the market softens, those bad loans are exposed. So no one has talked about the fact that people like Barney Frank and Chris Dodd and others were the ones that were pushing for these affordable lending goals almost as if it was an entitlement. That point has not been made at all.
Yeah. Dean Baker?
Well, actually, most of the worst loans were from institutions that actually weren't subject to those regulations. I think you mean the Community Reinvestment Act. So most of the worst loans were from institutions like Countrywide, IndyMac, New Century. These were not subject to the Community Reinvestment Act. So I don't think that really follows. Now, Fannie and Freddie did, at the last few years, like 04, 05, 06, suddenly get in a very big way into the subprime market, and that's been their immediate hit. Now, I think they would have faced a very big hit anyhow because you even have a lot of prime debt that's going very bad. but I think that they were kind of late to the picture and really secondary actors. I think, you know, really the brunt of this, the bulk of this is, you know, Wall Street or the financial industry just going nuts. I think you're very hard-pressed to make the case that was driven by government regulation.
Thank you very much, Greg, for the call. Our next caller is Kurt in Pewaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was just wondering, I read a while back that due to our trade deficit with a lot of major countries like China and India, that the compensation for the deficit that we imported more than we exported to them, that I think they extended treasury notes for the Chinese to compensate for the deficit to back the financing of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And I thought, if that's the, is there a problem now that the Chinese want to pull out because it's not worth investing on their part into the treasury notes to back the financing because of the housing bubble, you know, first?
It's a very good question. I've been at a loss to try and understand what the Bank of China thinks it's doing. The direction of causation actually goes the other way. China has a policy of deliberately keeping its currency low and the dollar high. They buy up hundreds of billions of dollars every year, much of it in holding assets like Fannie and Freddie debt. But they do that as a, or so I thought, as a way to maintain their export markets to the United States, because if they didn't do that, their currency would rise against the dollar and they would export less to us. So I assumed that they were doing this with the intention of preserving their export market, knowing that they were going to take a really big loss. But I've been hearing reports from people with the Chinese central bank that they're upset about losing money. Now, if China's central bank is run by people who didn't understand they were going to lose money on those purchases, it's kind of scary. I mean, it most immediately hurts China, but it's kind of scary that you have people that control trillions of dollars that really don't have any clue what they're doing, because I could have told them they'd have lost a lot of money on that. I could have guaranteed it they'd have lose money on that. So I don't know if they're really upset or not. It's very hard to understand. They should have known they were going to lose money on those purchases.
Next, we'll go to Tom in Fond du Lac. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was just wondering if the bond rating houses, who I think are complicit in this whole thing, are going to be chastised in any way. I mean, they vetted these things, these CDOs, really not knowing what they were worth.
That's a good question. To date, they haven't really been. I could imagine. Actually, I think there have been some lawsuits. I shouldn't say that. I think there were some lawsuits directed against some of the bond rating agencies saying that they hadn't done their job. So my guess is that they will take somewhat of a hit out of this. There is a big issue that there's an inherent conflict of interest that when, you know, Citigroup or whoever it is wants a bond rated, you know, they call up Moody's, call up whoever it is. They're paying them to do the rating. So there's this inherent conflict of interest that, you know, if you're Moody's or Standard & Poor's, you know that, you know, the people who are paying your bill want you to give them a good rating. And if you don't give them a good rating, well, they might call your competitor next time. So there's a real incentive to inflate your rating. And, you know, there are easy ways around that. The simplest thing is that you just have a third party. Say you have the stock exchange. You have the New York Stock Exchange. Send out the rater. You know, so if I'm Citigroup and I have a new bond issue I want rated, I call up the stock exchange, say, send someone out. They send me the bill, but I don't pick them. Yeah. You know, so that, you know, there are other ways you could do it. But I'm just saying that you could remove control over who designates the rater from the company, and that would remove this inherent conflict of interest, which is a problem.
We'll have to leave it there for now. I want to thank you, Dean Baker, for being with us and answering our callers' questions.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. We'll get another guest professor of economics to join us after the news. Van Mobley from Concordia University in Wisconsin will be on hand to talk with you. We are talking about how the latest Wall Street upheaval will affect our pocketbook and our politics during this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 7:36 on this Tuesday, September the 16th. The Dow posted its largest one-day loss yesterday since the September 11th attacks, the downturn caused by the fallout of the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy and the sale of Merrill Lynch to the Bank of America. We're talking about that fallout as well and welcoming your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest for this half hour is Van Mobley, Associate Professor of History and Economics at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and a trustee in the Village of Thiensville. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
I talked with economist Dean Baker in our first half hour, wondering whether this was the worst of it or if we're still going to have some bad news to come. He thought this was not the worst of it. What do you say?
You never know. I certainly wouldn't bet on it one way or the other. I don't think now's the time. I wouldn't encourage any of your listeners to engage in any speculation about right now with their money in the financial markets.
What do you mean? I mean, should we just leave it there and not worry about it?
Well, that's what I've done. I mean, I'm frozen. I'm not putting any new money in, and I'm not taking any of the money that I'm not selling either. I don't know if that's the path of wisdom, but when you don't know exactly what to do, I always suggest just be still.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was watching some news coverage on this yesterday, and the bank that holds my mortgage, it was my credit union, sold my mortgage to Washington Mutual, and people were waiting for that one to tumble.
Well, maybe if they tumble, they'll stop cashing your checks, huh, when you send them in.
Well, I was going to say, what does this mean to all of us who are holding our mortgages and trying to pay them off and watching our 401ks dwindle? This upheaval on Wall Street is affecting our pocketbooks, isn't it?
It is affecting our pocketbooks. If you have a 401k, or maybe if you have some mutual money in a mutual fund, then clearly if you look at your balance, then you'll see that it's been affected. For the people who are in a mortgage that they can afford and it's okay, it wouldn't really matter. You said that you sent in your payment to Washington Mutual.
Mm-hmm.
If Washington Mutual were to fail, that asset would be divvied up and given out to Washington Mutual's creditors. You'd still send in your check, and for a lot of people along those lines, things wouldn't necessarily change. Last time I was on here, we were talking about the financial crisis back in the summer. I encouraged your audience that, you know, they're okay. There's no reason to become worried about, for example, the money in their banks, except for a variety of rules. If you're below $100,000, then you're covered by the FDIC. And at the time, I encourage people to, you know, if you have $500,000 sitting in a bank somewhere, then you might want to think about fragmenting that and making a few friends at some other banks. And I still think that's a cautious and prudent precaution to take.
Yeah. The Bush administration is hinting that Wall Street should not expect any more rescues from Washington. President Bush, though, says he's confident that the markets have the resilience to deal with the current turmoil. Do you go along with that?
Well, I do think that we've seen a number of different approaches from Washington, and in particular Hank Paulson. I know he had intervened with the Bear Stearns to help prop up Bear Stearns and get Bear Stearns purchased by, I believe it was J.P. Morgan. And then he intervened with Fannie and Freddie. And people have been asking a lot of questions about, you know, why did he save Bear Stearns mm-hmm. and Fannie and Freddie and then cast Lehman to the dogs? And I actually think the answer is much more pragmatic than people have been said. And that's, he tried intervening to save these companies. He did intervene to save those companies. It didn't stop the financial rot. And now he's going to try something else, and we'll see if we can get a hard bottom after we let a few of them go under.
Yeah, well, this financial rot, according to our former guest, was caused a lot by lack of regulation. Do you agree?
I think a lack of regulation where you needed to have some regulation and maybe too much of the wrong kind of regulation. Sometimes what happens if you have, and I'll be specific on what I think. I think that they allowed the capital ratios to get way out of whack, and that is they allowed these financial institutions to have too much leverage. I've heard, you know, like 30 to 1. For basically every $1 in capital they have, they get to make $30 in loans, and that's a problem that the regulation was incorrect. They should have been regulating that, and they weren't. The other thing is maybe they have a lot of regulations, and they get people's distracted to looking at things that don't matter as much. So I believe I would just say that's it. too much regulation in some areas, not enough where it counted. So certainly where it counted, there wasn't enough regulation.
We'll take some calls for you. Ken in Black River Falls is with us next. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
In the 20s, it was possible to acquire stock with a 10% margin payment. Mm-hmm. And that was regulated out of existence by, of all people, I believe, Joseph Kennedy, who made more doing that than almost anyone else. Next, we come into the 70s, and with 10% down, using private mortgage insurance, an industry that I worked in for many years, you are able to acquire an asset with the confidence that it's going to go up in value. And people did that. And for a long time, there was this tremendous inflation in home prices. And it's peculiar that you could acquire an asset that's 70 years old, needs repairs, and oh, it's going to go up in value. It always puzzled me, even when I was involved in that business. And what we've done is we've created securities backed by all sorts of mortgages. We have securities that are backed by mortgages which are adjustable rate mortgages which weren't properly underwritten. And it's just become a colossal problem. It took a little longer than it did for the 20s to unfold or unwind or unravel, whatever the word would be. But it's happening now, and I don't know how it's going to end because housing is a tremendous generator for many, many segments of the economy. I mean, you buy a house, you buy carpets, you buy appliances, you do this, you do that. And I don't know how you get out of this. The only thing that I can really think of is that the infrastructure of this country is falling apart. And, I mean, I'm on a road right now that certainly could use a lot of work. Maybe we have to go back to public works, getting people to work. But then I'm worried, how do we prevent an inflationary trend without some sort of price controls? I'm puzzled.
Yeah, so am I. How's this going to end, Van Mobley?
Well, I believe it was Ken brought up a good point, and I would also agree with him. What we have here, the problems that we've encountered are really rooted in some long-term trends in the American economy. And I'll tell you one. I'll go ahead and, Joy, tell you my pet peeve, and I'm a little bit of an economic heretic on this. Part of what we see now is the long drive, really beginning after the end of the Cold War, towards globalization in the economy. And what we convinced ourselves that what we ought to do is specialize in certain sectors of our economy and let other sectors of our economy go overseas. And what we've done, for example, is, and Hank Paulson, bless his heart, he said it himself. You won't catch him saying it now. When he first became Secretary of the Treasury, he said how wonderful it was that the United States had specialized in financial services because that's where we had our comparative advantage. We needed to specialize in financial services and then let other people do our manufacturing for us and then, you know, maybe produce our energy. We just do financial services. Well, now nobody wants our financial services. We don't have a manufacturing sector. Our infrastructure is crumbling. We can't produce energy. And we really are kind of in a fix because the rest of the world is going to look at us and say, we're kind of like Lehman Brothers. And they just want to get away from us as fast as they can, and who can blame them? And we're going to have to alter the way we fundamentally do things at home to get out of this mess. Now, I'll throw in a plug for John McCain, who, Joy, you know I support. Mm-hmm. I believe that he has said and he intends to lead reform. Now, I'll also say that Barack Obama makes that same claim, and I think that he'll probably change the direction of the company as well. So both of them will. The question that I hope, as the campaign season winds on down here, that we'll see specific policies on things like, are we going to do infrastructure? How are we going to do it? How are we going to do some energy policy? Those are the things that that both of them have identified, and they're moving in the right direction, and I certainly want to encourage them to keep moving in the right direction, and we'll just have to buckle up, and things will change, but we'll be all right.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about the politics and the policies coming up after we check the weather. Talking with Van Mobley, Associate Professor of History and Economics at Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon. Van Mobley was an alternate delegate at the Republican National Convention for John McCain. He's also a trustee in the Village of Thiensville, talking with us about the Wall Street meltdown, or upheaval anyway, with yesterday's bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers and the merger of Merrill Lynch to Bank of America and other developments. Have a question, a reaction? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 12 minutes before 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, September the 16th. Coming up after 8 o'clock, I'm going to talk with the author of the new book, The Numerati. We'll find out exactly who the Numerati are and what they want. They're looking through all the data that we produce every day of our lives by clicking on web pages, by using a credit card. We'll find out what they're using this data for coming up after 8 o'clock. Right now, we're talking about the economy, and we're talking about the financial crisis that has spread to Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch on Wall Street yesterday. Talking with Van Mobley, Associate Professor of History and Economics at Concordia University, Wisconsin. The news certainly getting reaction on the campaign trail, the presidential campaign trail. John McCain yesterday did say that greed and corruption played a part in the crisis, and that he and Sarah Palin were going to clean up Wall Street and shake up Washington. Barack Obama reacted this way.
And I certainly don't fault Senator John McCain for these problems, but I do fault the economic philosophy he subscribes to, because it's the same philosophy we've had for the last 8 years.
So, Van Mobley, is John McCain going to be able to fix Wall Street?
He's going to try, and so will Barack Obama. And they haven't really given the details. Neither one of them have given the details. They don't want to burn up their credibility while the thing crashes, because there's nothing they can do to avert it now. And I think that that's a mark of wisdom on their part. They want to save their powder and then be in a position to lead, as opposed to get mangled up in the mess that we have right now.
Yeah, but some sort of new regulation is inevitable, Van Mobley?
I do believe it is inevitable. I was a critic of many of the regulations. Well, I'll tell you how this this game works, Joy. I was a critic of many of the policy changes in the Fed back in 2002. I wrote a lot of letters. They always ask for public comment whenever they make some regulatory changes. I wrote a lot of letters to them at the time. And at that time, I was an assistant professor. I've been promoted since to an associate professor. Mm-hmm. It's not much of a difference. I didn't get much of a pay raise or anything. But
congratulations, anyway.
Yeah. From a little small school in Wisconsin, and you can imagine, I imagine the pleasure and the glee all those Ivy Leaguers that working at the Fed got when they got my criticisms of their stuff, of their proposed regulation changes. And then they would write me back snippy little letters explaining to me that I didn't understand anything. And I get a little pleasure reading those old letters now.
Yeah. Let's take some calls. Mike in Winona is with us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm glad you have a historian on, because now he can validate my recollection of things. But back in December 2000, Bill Clinton signed some legislation that was championed, I believe, by Phil Graham, who McCain touted as being an expert in economics. And that had to do, or it was referred to as the Enron loophole, and that had to do with deregulation of our monetary financial system. And in the following 6 to 8 years, it was brought in, Congress kept bringing it up, trying to get that repealed, and it kept getting blocked by the Republicans. Once the Democrats had control of Congress, or at least had a one-vote majority, it was brought up in front of Bush, and he vetoed it. I also wanted to make the comment that back when George 43 was campaigning for his first term, there was a lot of talk about taking some of our Social Security dollars and being put into the financial market so that we could earn a higher interest rate. And boy, am I glad we didn't allow that to happen.
Yeah, all right. Let me first, did Mike have it right in his history lesson there, Van Mobley?
Yeah, he did. Well, partially, I think. One of the things he talked about is I think that financial re-regulation that he's talking about at the end of the Clinton years was basically the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act had established two sorts of financial institutions, regular commercial banks like M&I or Associated, that take deposits that are covered by the FDIC. And then you had investment banks, and some of those investment banks are Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, the former Merrill Lynch, Lehman, Bear Stearns. All those investment banks on Wall Street were regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. And the commercial banks are really regulated by the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, sort of some different things. Now, what happened when they repealed the Glass-Steagall Act is all these different type of banks sort of, it suddenly became unclear who regulated what and what sorts of different types of businesses that they could engage in. And it may be, if you look at it from a long term, that the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act just simply eliminated the possibility of an investment bank. So, for example, in the years since then and just recently, Bear Stearns has gone out of business, Lehman has gone out of business, Merrill Lynch has been bought by Bank of America, and there's talk that the two remaining investment banks that were formerly regulated by the SEC, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, may be purchased by a commercial bank, in which time you may get a situation where really one of the regulators that we had before at the Securities and Exchange Commission no longer has anyone to regulate. So he is very astute to point to that piece of legislation in the late 90s or 2000 as playing a role in this crisis. I think it did. And, that long-term outcome, maybe we'll see.
Yeah. Well, Mike thinks we'd really be in a pickle if we would have went forward with that partial privatization of Social Security and people were investing their Social Security funds into the stock market.
Yeah, and that's part of the there could be the devil is always in the details. The only thing that I would say on that is we don't want to, moving forward as we reform, and I would certainly encourage both McCain and Obama to think about this, is you never want to fight the last battle in your reform. You have to anticipate. You want to make sure that you don't repeat the mistakes of the past, but always remember that the new challenges you face are always just a little bit different than the ones in the past and sort of make arrangements for that.
We're going to move on to Vicki in Mequon. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, my undergraduate thesis in the early 80s was entitled The Adjustable Rate Mortgage, The American Nightmare.
Yeah.
And I've always believed it, and it's come to be true.
You're a fortune teller.
It's basically, I feel people don't understand them. But my question is, are money market funds at mutual fund companies safe? And what do you think about the viability of the mutual fund industry?
Mutual funds. It's one of those other things that the devil's in the details on those. There are a lot of good mutual funds, and I own some myself, and there are some very poor ones. I wouldn't make any blanket statements about the safety of money market funds at mutual funds in general, because I know that there have been some people who have already, back in the spring, got burned pretty heavily on some what they thought to be super safe money market funds with a variety of financial institutions. So I'm not going to make any blanket statement. I would say read your prospectus carefully, and then it may be safe, and it may be that would be one of the areas where you would want to make a change.
Yeah. Thank you, Vicki. Mike in Oshkosh is with us, I think, last. Go ahead, Mike.
Good morning. I'm wondering what the guest thinks. To what extent is a rational solution to this problem going to be thwarted, stymied, and completely complicated by a presidential election where both sides, frankly, are engaged in soundbite politics and are completely willing, like Senator Obama yesterday, to sabotage any realistic approach to solve this thing, trying to hang blame and completely assassinate the other side, make it seem like they're the ones that have completely, destroyed the economy? Is this a perfect storm of circumstances where rational solutions simply aren't going to happen? I saw last night, instead of watching Monday Night Football, I was watching CNBC, and the two representatives on both sides, I mean, seemed completely irrational in approaches to this thing. They were just trying to hang blame. You know, we're really, it had no place, and I'll take my call off the air.
Yeah, we have less than a minute to go.
I would just say that we're in a bad way, and we're going to have to try different things, and just figuring out what a rational solution is very difficult in these type of circumstances, and really, you have to pick up some of the, learn from history, and I'll give you one of my favorite presidents, even though I'm a Republican, is FDR. And FDR knew that in times like this, you try something, and if it works, then great. And if it doesn't work, you try something else. And I think that that's the sort of flexibility that we're going to have to show going forward. And what we can't afford is to be frozen in the thinking loop, what I call frozen in the thinking loop. Now, I don't encourage people to do silly things, but we can't just try to analyze and get the perfect remedy for this crisis, or we'll be frozen because there aren't any.
Thank you very much, Van Mobley, for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Joy.
Van Mobley, Associate Professor of History and Economics at Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon. Thanks to Rob Ferret for producing the hour. Thanks to Bill Martins and Cynthia Schuster for on-air production and direction. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.